Now this today will be part three of this sermon series, focusing on a sort of an unknown or a little known godly hero, Jehoiada. This will be part three. Over the last 2 weeks, we've learned a lot of different characters in this somewhat of a drama. I don't think Hollywood could ever come up with anything quite like this. It's true history. And there are some definite spiritual lessons associated with Jehoiada, the little-known hero working in the shadows. That part I will review. Even in horrible, frightening, evil, and chaotic, and ungodly times, like the times of Jehoiada, but also the United States of America in 2018. Horrible, frightening, chaotic, ungodly times. It doesn't matter how bad the times are. There are still going to be silent heroes, my term. The biblical term is a remnant. There's going to be a faithful remnant serving the true God, a remnant who knows and serves the true God. And in this story, that's Jehoiada. He's so much in the shadows that it took us a long time to even find him and all the background we went through the last two Sabbaths. But he was there all along, knowing and serving the true God. So that should be an encouragement. I believe I'm talking to some silent heroes right now that, by and large, the world is not aware of. We don't leave a large footprint on the world scene, but there are individuals in this room who know the true God and serve the true God regardless of what you see on the news. That is still a reality. The second spiritual lesson, timeless truth number two, come out of her, my people. Unholy alliances between good and evil do not work. They do not work. They don't produce good fruits. There is no fellowship, righteousness with unrighteousness. And even though it seems like there are advantages in the short run, the lesson of the Bible and the lesson of this history that we're looking at in Kings and Chronicles is that they don't produce good fruits. Unholy alliances between good and evil. The third timeless truth, even though blood is thicker than water, and there's a tendency, a natural, understandable tendency to make allowances for blood relatives, we should not do that. We should not make major, important decisions in life based on who we're related to physically. We need to make decisions based on who our spiritual family is and our spiritual father and our spiritual elder brother. And that becomes very obvious in this lesson of Jehoiada. Even though blood is thicker than water, it is sometimes a very gooey and deadly and incorrect basis for important decisions in life. And then the fourth timeless truth, no individual in the long run is going to succeed with God and God's judgment based on somebody else's righteousness. You can only lean on somebody else. I can only lean on somebody else so long. At some point, everybody has to stand on their own two feet before God. And that certainly is evident in this story, and it will become very evident today. So with that little bit of background, I want to dive right into the story. Now, there's going to be a little lead up to just reading verse by verse through Kings and Chronicles. We'll start with a character that we met a little bit in the past leading up to that. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 22. One of the better known characters in this true drama is Ahab, about which very little good can be said. But there was one thing that Ahab did that was right, and it was recorded in the scriptures. One time, at least, he did repent, and God noticed it. And what we're going to look at right now is the fruit of that. Read properly, understood properly, what we're going to see, even Ahab's death was an evidence of God's mercy. Because you'll remember from 2 weeks ago that there was another character that we're also going to look at shortly named Jehu, God's assassin. And his job was to wipe out the entire line of Ahab, the entire dynasty of Ahab up in the north in Samaria. And so you didn't want to meet Jehu when he was carrying out God's assignment, because he was a fierce warrior and a fierce, bloody man. And Ahab would have been the logical first person for Jehu to kill under God's direction. But it turns out he wasn't. Now, he did die otherwise. But he died a somewhat more merciful death, a somewhat more noble death than he would have otherwise had he not repented. Let's pick it up. 1 Kings 22, not going to do me any good to be in Isaiah 43, so let me catch up with you. 1 Kings 22, we'll start in verse 29. If you just read this casually and quickly, you might not think, well, this is a mercy to Ahab. I think it actually was. Let's read it. 1 Kings 22, beginning in verse 29. So the king of Israel, that's Ahab, and Jehoshaphat, that's the king of Judah. And if you do have your handout from a couple of weeks ago or last week, left and right side. Right side is basically evil. That's Samaria. That's Israel. That's Ahab. Left side, basically good by comparison. That's Judah. That's Jehoshaphat. Well, they're here together, just like they are in the handout. The king of Israel, Ahab, and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead. Ramoth-Gilead was a city, a stronghold on the right, or the east side of the Jordan River. You remember when Israel inherited the Promised Land. 2.5 of the tribes wanted to stay on the other side of the Jordan River, and God let that happen. The half-tribe of Manasseh and Reuben and Gad, they stayed on the east side, and they settled. That was their inheritance. Well, this is a city over there that Israel had for many decades, or centuries even. But the Syrians had conquered that. And that's what this war is. Ramoth-Gilead, that city. The king of Israel, Ahab, and Jehoshaphat in an unholy alliance. Jehoshaphat should not have been in this military campaign with Ahab, but he was. They went up to Ramoth-Gilead. And the king of Israel, Ahab, said to Jehoshaphat, look, I'm going to disguise myself. You go ahead and wear your kingly robes, stand out like a sore thumb, be a target for the Syrian army. I don't care. I'm not going to do that. I am going to go incognito because I think they're after me, not you. So you go ahead and wear your robes and your kingly crown and all that, but I'm going to dress like a common soldier. That's what Ahab said to Jehoshaphat. Who is Ahab looking out after? Ahab. So he says, I'm going to disguise myself and go into battle. You go ahead and put on your robes. So the king of Israel disguised himself and went into battle. Probably had armor underneath his common soldier's attire. He didn't look like a king. He didn't want to look like a king because a king would be a target. Now the king of Syria had commanded the 32 captains of his chariot saying, fight with no one, small or great, but only with the king of Israel. Ahab was right. He was the target. Here's the commander of the Syrian army saying, I don't care if you kill another soldier. I want you to kill Ahab, their king. There's some bad blood here between the Syrians and Ahab and the house of Omri. So basically just go for the one target, the king of Israel. Well, Ahab was right. He was the target. Fight with no one, small or great, but only with the king of Israel. So it was, verse 32, when the captains of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat. Now he looks like a king. The Syrians don't know Jehoshaphat near as well as they do Ahab. So they see somebody that looks like a king. They say, that must be the guy. We were commanded to divert all of our attention on him. So they bore in from all directions on Jehoshaphat. He's thinking at this point, what have I got myself into? Why did I agree to come up here with Ahab and fight his battles? But anyway, he's in the crosshairs of, I don't know, 1,000, 10,000 archers. Surely it is the king of Israel, they said. Therefore they turned aside to fight against him. Jehoshaphat cried out. Well, so would you. Now, in terror, maybe he's crying out to God. He knew the true God. Maybe he's crying out to God. Maybe he's repenting of even being there. Shouldn't have been there. But he says he cries out. And just before he takes about 15 arrows, they recognize that's not the guy we're after. So verse 33, it happened when the captains of the chariots, that's of the Syrian army, saw that it was not the king of Israel. They knew what Ahab looked like. This isn't he. This is not he. That they turned back from pursuing him. Whew, if you're Jehoshaphat. Now a certain man drew a bow at random. So Ahab's pretty smart. He anticipated what was going to happen. He's going to outsmart all of the Syrian army. He kind of got away with one Jehoshaphat, his so-called friend. Can he outsmart God? A part of the story we didn't even have time for in previous weeks. A previous prophet of God, not even Elijah, had told Ahab, your days are numbered. And I think Ahab is aware of that. But he's going to outsmart even the prophecy of God. I'll just go incognito. Is God in charge of the flight path of 1,000 arrows? Is God in charge of the flight path of a single randomly shot arrow? Or in modern days, would God be able to steer the path of a single randomly shot bullet? Well, the question answers itself. Of course he could, and that's what happens right here. Read what happened. No, Ahab, you're not going to outsmart anybody. So it says, verse 34, a certain man, that's a Syrian archer, drew a bow at random. He's just shooting up in the air, seeing where it lands. Drew a bow at random and struck the king of Israel, Ahab, between the joints of his armor. So he's got armor plates, and there's maybe just an inch, a half inch, where they come together, where there's a gap. That arrow found that spot. That's human flesh. That's Ahab. He's a dead man. So he's wounded at this point. So he said to the driver of his chariot, turn around and take me out of the battle, for I'm wounded. The battle increased that day, and the king was propped up. So here he is bleeding to death in his chariot, but they prop him up. So I guess to encourage his soldiers to not give up the fight, at least they know their king isn't dead, even though he's not dressed like a king. So they prop him up for the rest of the battle, facing the Assyrians, and he died at evening. The blood ran out from the wound under the floor of the chariot. I got to tell you in advance, this is a pretty bloody story today. It was bloody last week. It's really going to be bloody. But, you know, we talked about God's judgment in one of those four lessons. God is incredibly merciful. He's incredibly patient. But there comes a time when mercy ends and judgment starts, and oftentimes there's bloodshed. God endorsed bloodshed. God caused bloodshed. There's going to see a lot of it today. It's just the way it is. So he bleeds to death, all this blood in his chariot. So they take him back home, their dead king. They brought him back to Samaria, verse 37. And verse 38, then someone washed the chariot at a pool in Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood while the harlots bathed. So what an end. But it's better than Jehu getting a hold of him. He's able to die, in a sense, gloriously in battle. That's the way they looked at it, not by an assassin's sword. So this fulfilled a prophecy that had been given by that earlier prophet, that Ahab would die and dogs would lick up his blood. It happened years after the prophecy, but it did happen. When God says something's going to happen, it will happen. So his chariot with his dead body, and all this blood is taken place to wash it. Harlots are bathing there, and they rinse out the chariot and the dogs lick up the blood. That's the end of Ahab. But at least he got an honorable burial. Verse 40. So Ahab rested with his fathers. Then Ahaziah, his son, reigned in his place. So when we had the handout about Ahab, we saw that he had two sons that are in our story. One is this man we just saw, the oldest son, Ahaziah. Now he becomes the new king now that Ahab is dead. Ahab at least got an honorable burial. You're not going to see that when Jehu finds the rest of his descendants. But at least he did. And I attribute it to the fact that on that one occasion he did have a soft heart and repented. Anyway, so here we go. So the next thing we want to do is go later in this same chapter to verse 51. Learn a little bit about this son of his named Ahaziah, the son of Ahab. They all have a death sentence over them. All the descendants, all the male relatives of Ahab have a death sentence from God. We just saw how Ahab died. Jehu didn't get to him, but he'll get to a lot of the others. So in verse 51 of this same chapter, 1 Kings 22, verse 51, a very brief synopsis of this Ahaziah. Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel in Samaria in the 17th year of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah. And he reigned 2 years over Israel. He doesn't last very long. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal. He walked in the ways of his father and in the way of his mother, Ahab and Jezebel, and in the way of his mother and in the way of Jeroboam, the first rebel king of the northern kingdom way back, who introduced calf worship, the son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin. For Israel served Baal. The problem is we not only have calf worship, we have Baal worship introduced by this man's mother, Jezebel. For he served Baal and worshipped him, and he provoked the Eternal God of Israel to anger according to all that his father and mother had done. Now we skip, go to The very next book is 2 Kings, the very next chapter, chapter 1 of 2 Kings, verse 1. Moab rebelled against Israel after the death of Ahab. Now Ahaziah, the same man we were just looking at, he had an accident. He only lasted 2 years on the throne. He basically died of a fall, of an accident. It says he fell through the lattice of his upper room. So there was a window, apparently, with maybe a wood lattice or something that was supposed to protect people from falling out of the window. Well, apparently he was leaning on it and it gave way. That's what we would believe here. He fell through the lattice. However long the drop was, we don't know, but it was enough to severely injure him. Ahaziah fell through the lattice of his upper room in Samaria. He was injured. So he sent messengers. He wants to be healed. Who should he send messengers to? Well, a prophet of the true God. But that's not what he does. He sent messengers and said to them, "Go inquire of Baalzebub, the god of Ekron, whether I shall recover from this injury." Baalzebub is not going to heal Ahaziah. It's an open question. Would God have healed him? He might have, but he didn't ask God. There's the principle in the Bible, you have not because you ask not. Verse 3, and God noticed this. The angel of the Eternal said to Elijah the Tishbite. Last time we saw Elijah, he was down at Mount Sinai, hiding in a cave. God said, "There's unfinished business for you. Back up north. Go back." He was given three jobs to do. One of them was to anoint the assassin, Jehu. We're going to get to that in just a second. And another one was to find his replacement, Elisha, who would follow as the prophet. But at this point in time, Elijah is still around. He's still active. So the angel of the Eternal came to Elijah, the Tishbite, and it said, "Arise and go up to meet the messengers of the king of Samaria," this Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, "and say to them, is it because there's no God in Israel? Why are you sending to the prophets of Baalzebub? Why don't you ask the true God, the creator God? Is it because there's no God in Israel that you're going to inquire of Baalzebub, the god of Ekron?" And because he did that, verse 4, "Now therefore, thus says the Eternal, you shall not come down from the bed to which you have gone up. You shall surely die." So we go to verses 16 through 18 of the same chapter. His question was, will a God heal me? The true God sends his prophet and says, "No, you will not be healed. You didn't even ask the true God." So verse 16, he said to him, "Thus says the Eternal, because you have sent messengers to inquire of Baalzebub, the god of Ekron, is it because there's no God in Israel to inquire of his word? Therefore you shall not come down from the bed," this is a repeat of what we just read, "to which you have gone up, but you shall surely die." So Ahaziah died, according to the word of the Eternal, which Elijah had spoken. Because he had no son, Jehoram became king. Now that's not his son, that's his brother. Back to the handout from last week, you see that there's a man named Joram or Jehoram. It is spelled both ways. That's the other son, the second son of Ahab. Now there's a death penalty on the entire lineage of Ahab. Ahab, we've already seen, he's dead. He died in battle. His first son, he just died from an injury. But what about all the other male relatives of Ahab? Well, the next in line is this Joram or Jehoram. So verse 17, Joram, that's his brother, younger brother, became king in his place in the second year of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. And that's where it gets confusing. There's another Jehoram over in Judah on the left side of the page. So the Joram the Joram that's just taken office up in the north is the brother-in-law of the Joram that's over on the left side through this intermarriage that was arranged by Jehoshaphat and Ahab. And there's two Jehorams, or Joram. All right, so now let's follow the story a little bit more. We go to chapter 3. So now the younger brother of Ahaziah, the younger son of Ahab, is on the throne. His name is either Joram or Jehoram, spelled variously. The brother-in-law of the Jehoram on the left side, who's also king in Judah. We go to chapter 3, and we look at the first couple of verses. Jehoram, the son of Ahab, that's the man we're talking about, became king over Israel at Samaria in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, and reigned 12 years. So he lasts longer. God pronounces a death penalty. Does he always... This is another lesson, this story. If God says something's going to happen, does it have to happen in the next 5 minutes? Does the passage of 12 years mean God has failed or his prophecies have failed? No. It will happen in God's time. So he was on the throne for 12 years. How come Jehu didn't get to him before 12 years? Well, take it up with God. I mean, I don't know, but it is going to happen. Whether it happens in 6 minutes or 12 years, it will happen. All right, so verse 2. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal. Yeah, like father, like mother, like son, like Ahab, like Jezebel, like Joram. Not quite as bad as his father and mother. He at least did something halfway good. He put away the sacred pillar of Baal that his father had made at the behest of his mother, Jezebel. At least he started to diminish the worship of Baal a little bit. Now, he didn't do anything about the golden calves. I mean, this is a baby step in the right direction. But again, the Bible is very fair. It says the slightly good things about evil people, and it shows the sins and the weaknesses of righteous people. It's a very balanced approach. So he's not quite as bad as Ahab and Jezebel. Verse 3, nevertheless, he persisted in the sin of Jeroboam. That goes back to the calf worship. That was the original problem with Samaria. So he did a little bit about Baal worship, but nothing about the calf worship that Jeroboam had introduced, who had made Israel sin. He did not depart from that. All right, now we go to chapter 9. So we've got the second son of Ahab now on the throne. We're still waiting for Jehu to show up. Well, let's go find out. 2 Kings chapter 9. Maybe your Bible's like mine. Chapter heading, Jehu, anointed king of Israel. It's been a while. Goes clear back to when God saw Elijah back at the cave in Mount Sinai. Well, let's pick it up here. One of the things he was to do was to ordain his successor. Now, this is a little something you have to put the pieces together. Elijah was told to ordain Jehu, the assassin, and he would be the new king after he killed out all the descendants of Ahab's. Whether he did this with God's permission or not, I'm not sure. I don't know. All I know is what it says here. Elijah handed that assignment off to his successor, Elisha. We're going to see Elisha, his successor, actually finding Jehu and anointing him, sort of. I get the impression nobody wanted to deal with Jehu. Elisha does it through his assistant. So Elijah says, Elisha, you do it. Elisha says, you assistant, you do it. And finally, they found somebody to go do it. That's the story we're going to see. Now, maybe this was all done with God's permission. I don't know. You know, there is delegation authority. Elijah did not in person look up Jehu. Elijah first found Elisha and said, Elisha, you're my successor. Elisha, did he do the job in person? No, he found one of his assistants. But finally, we got somebody to do it. So, chapter 9, verse 1. Elisha the prophet, Elijah's successor, called one of the sons of the prophet. Now, that doesn't mean he had his DNA. Sons of the prophet is a term used to mean disciples or students of the prophets. We know Elijah and Elisha had schools. Mr. Armstrong raised up 3 colleges. He had a lot of students. Those could have been called the sons of Mr. Armstrong, in a sense. They're the school of the prophets. And the young men who went to the school and were trained in righteousness under Elijah and Elisha, they were called the sons of the prophets. Well, he's got one of his sons, one of his students, one of his disciples. Elisha the prophet called one of the sons of the prophets and said to him, get yourself ready, take the flask of oil in your hand and go to Ramoth Gilead. That same city we saw on the right side, the east side of the Jordan River that they had been battling over and when Ahab got killed. Now, when you arrive at that place, look there for Jehu. Jehu was a military man. Probably in today's parlance, we'd say he was a colonel or a general. He was a military leader of Israel's army. Probably a rough and gruff guy. Didn't mind shedding blood. He was a military man. So Elisha tells one of his disciples, you go and anoint. Find this man Jehu, Colonel Jehu, General Jehu, and make him the new king. Do it in private. Look there for Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat. Son of Jehoshaphat? How does that work? Well, that just is one of those strange coincidences. Jehu was the son of Jehoshaphat, but that's not the Jehoshaphat that we've been talking about. That's just another Jehoshaphat. You know, Tom, Dick, and Harry. There's a lot of Toms, a lot of Harrys in Israel. There's a lot of Jehoshaphats, apparently. Pure coincidence. This is not the Jehoshaphat that's on the left side of our handout. All right, so find this Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, and go in and make him rise up from among his associates and take him into an inner room. Do this in private. Do this in private. Take the flask of oil and pour it on his head and say, thus says the Eternal, I, the Eternal God, have anointed you king over Israel. Then open the door and flee. I don't think he probably needed a lot of encouragement on that. Nobody likes to deal with Jehu. So do it and then get out. And we'll see that's exactly what happened. Verse 4, the young man, I assume he's either ignorant of who Jehu is or he's a very brave young man. One of two. Maybe both. So the young man, the servant of the prophet, went to Ramoth-Gilead, and when he arrived there, there were the captains, all the officers of the army there, sitting. And he said, I have a message for you, O commander, colonel, general, whatever it is, Jehu. And Jehu said, For which one of us? And he said, for you, commander. So he, that is Jehu, arose and went into the house. They go into a private room. And he, the son of the prophet, poured the oil on his head and said to him, thus says the Eternal God of Israel, I have anointed you king over the people of the Eternal over Israel. Now, Jehu's thinking, wait a minute, there's already a king. His name's Joram. Well, kill him. You shall strike down the house of Ahab, your master. Ahab himself is already gone. Ahaziah himself is already gone. The one representing the house of Ahab now is Joram. You shall strike down the house of Ahab, your master. That I, this is, God is endorsing this. It's the only time when man has the right to take man's life is when God has assigned a person that responsibility. And God has in this case. That I, through you, may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets. All the evil that had come from Ahab and Jezebel. It's now going to be avenged. And the blood of all the servants of the Eternal at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish. And I will cut off from Ahab all the males in Israel, both bond and free. Any male that would be able to trace themselves to Ahab has a death sentence over them. That entire dynasty is wiped out, going to be wiped out. And a new dynasty, the Jehu dynasty, will begin. So I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam. The first dynasty of Israel was all wiped out. Jeroboam and his descendants were eventually all wiped out. And like the house of Baasha, that was the second dynasty up in Samaria. They were all wiped out. Omri, Ahab, the third one, it's going to be wiped out. We're going to have a fourth one coming on here pretty soon, Jehu's. It says, the dog shall eat Jezebel in the vicinity of Jezreel. Now, that's not for the faint-hearted to even think about that. But these are severe penalties for severe sins. So that's not quite as bad, I guess, as Ahab. His blood was licked up. Now her corpse is going to be eaten by dogs. Horrible. The dog shall eat Jezebel in the vicinity of Jezreel, and there shall be none to bury her. And he opened the door and fled. What he was told to do. You don't hang around Jehu any longer than you have to. Verse 11, then Jehu came out to the servants of his master. So he comes out with all the other officers, and they're saying, well, what was that all about? At first he is evasive. Then Jehu came out to the servants of his master, and one of them said, is all well? You know, everything okay? What was that all about? Why did this madman come to you? That's the way the world usually looks at a servant of God. They're crazy. This is one of the sons of the prophets. What's that? What that crazy guy? What was that all about? And at first he kind of gives them a non-answer. He blows them off. He says, you know the man and his babble. They said, so they pressed him on it. Well, that's a lie. Come on, tell us the truth. Tell us. So he said, okay. thus and thus he spoke to me. He told him the story. He says, I'm the new king. Thus says the Eternal, I've anointed you king over Israel. Then they got real respectful of Jehu because he's their new king now. He was their general before, now he's their king. So it says, each man, verse 13, hastened to take his garment and put it under him on the top of the steps, and they blew trumpets saying, Jehu is king. All right, so that's finally the job that had been given to Elijah, which he handed off to Elisha, who he handed off to one of the sons of the prophet Jehu, has now been ordained by a man of God to be the new king and has been given the job of killing, wiping out the whole family of Ahab. So let's keep reading, verse 14. So Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, conspired. Jehoshaphat is, again, not the Jehoshaphat we've been familiar with. It's just a coincidence. Jehu, the new king, the son of Nimshi, conspired against Joram. All right, that's the remaining son there of Ahab, sitting on the throne in Samaria. Now, Joram had been defending Ramoth-Gilead. So there was just this long, prolonged back-and-forth battle for this town of Ramoth-Gilead between Israel and Syria. Just a long, like the Western Front in World War I. They just back and forth, nothing really being accomplished. So they're still there battling it out. Joram had been defending Ramoth-Gilead, he and all Israel, against Hazael, the king of Syria. But King Joram had returned to Jezreel to recover from the wounds which the Syrians had inflicted on him when he fought with Hazael, the king of Syria. So Joram has now been wounded, and they've taken him back to Jezreel. Jehu said, if you are so minded, let no one leave or escape from the city to go and tell it to Jezreel. So he tells all his associates, all the others in the army, what he's going to do. I'm going to go kill Jehu. He's already been wounded. I'm going to finish him off. Don't anybody say a word. Don't anybody let anybody know, because a spy might be here, and go warn Jehu, and they may hide him. So don't anybody tell what's about to happen. So Jehu, verse 16, rode in a chariot and went to Jezreel, for Joram was laid up there, and Ahaziah, king of Judah. Now this Ahaziah is over on the left side of our handout, and he is the nephew of Joram, who's about to be killed through this intermarriage that we saw last time between the two houses. So both Ahaziah, the king of Judah, and Joram, the wounded king of Israel, are there in Jezreel. And Jehu's going to knock them both out. Wait a minute, I thought Jehu was supposed to knock out that family of Jehu, of Ahab, on the right side of the handout. He is, but guess what? There's been intermarriage, and now there's some of that blood over on the left side. And that blood over on the left side, those relatives on the left side, they're going to be slaughtered by Jehu also. He's going to get two kings at one time on this one. Because Ahaziah is brother-in-law to Joram, and they're fighting together at this city. All right, so a watchman, verse 17, stood on the tower in Jezreel, and he saw the company of Jehu as he came, and he said, I see a company of men. And Joram said, well, get a horseman and send him to meet them and let him say, is it in peace? So they see Jehu, this assassin, coming at him 100 miles an hour. They say, who's that and what's that all about? So they send out a messenger to see if he's coming in peace. Well, he's not coming in peace. He's coming with blood in his eyes. So verse 18, so the horseman went to meet him and said, thus says the king, that's Joram, is it peace? Jehu said, what have you to do with peace? Real rough, gruff answer. No, I'm not coming in peace. What do you know about peace? What does your master Joram know about peace? Turn around and follow me. You can't even go back. You're one of my soldiers now. Just fall in behind me. And you read it on, and they send another messenger out. Are you coming in peace? What do you know about peace? Fall in behind me. If you don't fall in behind me, you'll die. So, verse 21, this wounded Joram, he probably knows what's happening, what's about to happen. So he says, make ready, verse 21. And his chariot was made ready. Then Joram, the king of Israel, and Ahaziah, his brother-in-law, the king of Judah. This is a point in time when Ahaziah probably wished he were not the brother-in-law of Joram. They went out to meet Jehu. and went out to meet Jehu, and they met him on the property of Naboth, the Jezreelite. Who's Naboth? Naboth was the innocent property owner who had been killed. His property many years ago was adjacent to Ahab's, and Ahab wanted it. And this man wouldn't sell it to Ahab. So Jezebel had him killed so her husband could get his property. And just by chance, look what's about to happen here. The son of Ahab is going to be killed and his body left on that same property that his father stole with murder. So verse 22. It happened when Joram saw Jehu, he said, "Is it peace?" Well, I think he knew it wasn't. So he answered, "What peace? As long as the harlotries of your mother Jezebel and her witchcraft are so many." So he's very zealous to carry out God's instructions to wipe out this evil family. Very zealous, Jehu is. Jehu drew his bow, verse 24, with full strength, and he shot Jehoram full strength between his arms, and the arrow came out at his heart. And he sank down in the chariot. Well, so would you if you had an arrow in the heart. Then Jehu said to Bidkar, his captain, "Pick him up and throw him into the tract of the field of Naboth." Poetic justice, divine poetic justice. The son of Ahab's body is thrown onto the ground that his father had stolen with murder from an innocent victim. And this fulfills a prophecy that God had given through a prophet earlier on, as it says in verses 25 and 26. All right, so there we're starting to see the family of Ahab disappear. Ahab's dead. Ahaziah's dead. Now Joram's dead. But there are still other male relatives. So let's continue on with the story. We go to chapter 10. Now Ahab had 70 sons. Sons in the sense of male relatives. They could be nephews. They could be even grandchildren. They could be uncles. I mean, these are male relatives of Ahab that could say, "Well, now it's my turn to be on the throne. Now that Ahab's two sons are dead, now it's my turn." 70 of them. Some of them might have been very young, still young children, because they had guardians over them. So let's read it. Ahab had 70 sons, male descendants, male relatives, in Samaria. And Jehu wrote letters and sent them to Samaria, to the rulers of Jezreel, where all 70 of these male relatives of Ahab are present. Here's what the letter said. As this letter comes to you, since your master's sons are with you, he's writing this to the guardians, to the secular officials who look after these descendants of Ahab. He's writing it to them. As soon as this letter comes to you, since your master, that's Ahab's sons, are with you, and you have chariots and horses, a fortified city also, and weapons, choose the best qualified of your master's sons, set him on his father's throne, and fight for your master's house. He basically challenges them. Are there any of you there who want to fight me? If you want to fight me, we'll fight. If you want to protect the 70 descendants of Ahab, then okay, fight. We'll have a fight. The reputation of Jehu is such, do they want to fight him? They're thinking, well, if we don't fight him, maybe he won't kill us. So verse 4, they were exceedingly afraid. This Jehu is a fierce person. And they said, look, two kings could not stand up to him. He just killed Joram, the son of Ahab, and he just killed, I didn't even get to that part, I guess, but he just killed Ahaziah. Two kings couldn't stand up to him. Who do we think we are? So we don't want to fight you, Jehu. Verse 5, he who was in charge of the house and he who was in charge of the city, the elders also, and those who reared the sons, sent to Jehu saying, we're your servants. You're the boss now. We're not going to fight you. Tell us what you want us to do. We'll do it. We'll do all you tell us, but we will not make anyone king. Do what is good in your sight. Gave him a blank check. Well, he was going to take it anyway, but they gave him a blank check. So he wrote a second letter. He says, okay, this is what you got to do. This is what you need to do to save your own lives. If you're for me, and if you will obey my voice, take the heads of the men, your master's sons, and come to me at Jezreel by this time. I want to see 70 heads detached from 70 bodies. Very bloody. Now the king's sons, 70 persons, were with the great men of the city who were rearing them. So it was, when the letter came to them, so they got a choice. We do this terrible thing, or we have to face Jehu. We'll do the terrible thing. When the letter came to them, they took the king's sons and slaughtered 70 persons, put their heads in baskets, and sent them to Jezreel. Then a messenger came and told him, saying, "They have brought the heads of the king's sons." He said, "Lay them on two heaps at the entrance of the gate until morning." Tough man here. That's why everybody in the city would see them. Nobody fights Jehu. If you fight Jehu, look what happens to you. So it was in the morning that he went out and stood and said to the people, "You are righteous." In other words, you're not to blame for these 70 heads here. That's me. And I did it because God told me to. So don't worry about what you did. I won't take any vengeance on you. You did it. You did it properly. Indeed, I conspired against my master and killed him. Know that nothing shall fall to the earth of the word which the eternal... Nothing shall fall to the earth of the word of the eternal, which the eternal spoke concerning the house of Ahab. This is divine justice. This gory sight you see, that's divine justice. You had a part in it, but it starts with God. So Jehu killed all... Now, here's a problem verse for Jehu. So far, we say Jehu's a rough and fierce man. He has zeal for the things of God. A very distasteful job, he does it. So far, so good. But verse 11 is a problem. Jehu killed all who remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel and all the great men. These are not relatives of Ahab. His killing went beyond what God told him to. Now he's killing other people, all the great men, and his close acquaintances, and his priests. He wasn't told to kill the priests, even though they're pagan priests of Ahab. He wasn't told to kill those people. So he went overboard. He stepped across a line he should not have stepped across. And this is the black mark on Jehu. And later, if you follow the history of Jehu, you'll find that God called him to account for this. Even a person in zeal for God can get proud. His pride. He was proud of his zeal. And out of proud, he overstepped his assignment, and it got him in trouble. It's another lesson of this whole story. Well, he's not through killing. Verse 12. So he's killed these 70 direct descendants of Ahab. But in his mind, he's not, and he's killed a lot of other people he shouldn't have. But verse 12, he's still not through killing. He arose and he departed and he went to Samaria. On the way at Beth Ekid of the shepherds, Jehu met with the brothers of Ahaziah, the king of Judah, and said, "Who are you?" And they said, "We are the brothers of Ahaziah. We have come down to greet the sons of the king and the sons of the queen mother." And he said, "Take them alive." So he took them alive and killed them. So this is part of the curse on the left-hand side of the page because of this intermarriage with the house of Ahab. Ahaziah, the nephew of Joram, was up there. I didn't read where Jehu killed him to. And now even relatives of Ahaziah get killed by Jehu. Verse 15, I guess. When he departed from there, after those people were all killed, he met Jehonadab, the son of Rechab. Now that could be a whole sermonette or almost a sermon. Who is Rechab? Some of you know that history. This was a person who saw the paganism that was developing in Israel, and he decided to go off the grid. He got out away from the cities, away from the pagan religion. He and his children, he and his descendants, he said, "We want nothing to do with this. We're going to go back and live nomadic lives to get away from all this idolatry." And that was a righteous thing. And the descendants of Rechab were honored by God for doing that. Well, here's one of them. They were on this road coming to meet him. And he greeted the son of Rechab, and Jehu greeted one another. And he says, "Is your heart right, as my heart is toward your heart?" And Jehonadab answered, "It is. We have no evil intentions. We're not going to fight you. You know our record. You know the record of our family." And Jehu didn't hurt them. He didn't harm them at all. He says, "You're zealous for God. I want to show you my zeal for God." He told him about all the people he'd killed. He's starting to become proud of his zeal. We already saw that he stepped over the line. So in verse 16, come with me and see my zeal for the eternal. He's bragging. He's let his pride start to spoil things. Verse 17, and when he came to Samaria, he killed all who remained to Ahab. So he did more killing. But there's a problem with Jehu. He kind of went overboard, and he paid a price later. Okay, we come to chapter 11. And now we dive right down into the story where we're going to come to our unknown hero here. All that background. Verse 1 of chapter 11. When Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab, when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead. Okay, so she married over onto the left side of the handout. She married into the line of Judah. She had married the son of Jehoshaphat, Jehoram. Well, he's now dead. And Jehoram's son and her son, Ahaziah, he's now dead. So she sees her husband dead. She sees her son dead. And the only thing between her and being the queen is her grandchildren. So we're going to see what she does to them. Like mother, like daughter. This is the daughter of Jezebel. Her husband's dead, her son is dead, but she still has some grandsons. When Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed all the royal heirs. She kills her grandsons. She thinks she kills all of them, at which point there would be nobody left of the line of David, and God's prophecy would have failed. But she didn't get them all, because there's a righteous person in the shadow and his wife who step to the front. Jehoshaphat, verse 2. This is the half-sister of Ahaziah, whose children are all being slaughtered. She has the same father as Ahaziah, Joram of Judah. She has a different mother. Her mother is not Athaliah. And she is married to the high priest, the hero of our story, Jehoiada, who nobody's ever heard of. But when it's time and when a remnant is needed for the plan of God to continue on, they somehow emerge from the shadows. Jehoshaphat, the daughter of King Joram, the sister of Ahaziah, half-sister, took Joash, this little one-year-old, this toddler, from among all the king's sons who were about to be slaughtered. She rescues this one. She stole him away from among the king's sons who were being murdered, and they hid them. Who's they? She and her husband, Jehoiada, and his nurse in the bedroom, from Athaliah, so that he was not killed. He was hidden with her in the house of the Eternal. Only the priest can go into the house of the Eternal. Yes, but she was married to the high priest, Jehoiada, who had access to all the secret rooms, the private rooms of the temple complex. And so they protect this little one-year-old named Joash from his murderous grandmother. He was hidden with her in the house of the Eternal for 6 years, while Athaliah reigned over the land, the queen of Judah, a daughter of Ahab from Samaria. In the 7th year, Jehoiada sent and brought the captains of the hundreds, of the bodyguards, and the escorts, and brought them into the house of the Eternal. Little Joash is now 7 years old. He's barely old enough now, but he's old enough now to be anointed the king, and his murderous grandmother to be gotten rid of, to be removed from the throne that he was entitled to. Joash was. A couple of times our family has been able to be in London when they have the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace. This is kind of like that. There was a bunch of people who were the guards around the temple complex, and on the Sabbath they had a changing of the guard, so the ones who had been on duty go off duty and the new ones come on. So now you have the old and the new, and you can double your force if you can get both the old, the ones going off duty, and the new, the ones coming on duty, in on your plan. So he plans a coup, although it's not really a coup. It's a legitimate coup. It's to get rid of the queen but put the rightful king on the throne. So our hero, Jehoiada, has stepped out of the shadows, and he's orchestrating all of this now. So he tells the guard contingent around the temple complex what he's up to. And he gets them to be loyal to this legitimate coup. All right, so let's read it. there in verse 4, he made a covenant with them and he took an oath from them in the house of the Eternal. He showed them the king's son. Probably most of them didn't even know this boy was alive. Nobody knew he was alive. He'd been reared in secrecy. But the time has now come for him to be enthroned. He's got a bunch of loyal soldiers now, or guards. Verse 5, he commanded them, saying, "This is what you shall do. One-third of you who come on duty on the Sabbath shall be keeping watch over the king's house. One-third shall be at the gate of Sur, and one-third at the gate behind the escorts. You shall keep the watch of the house, lest it be broken down." So the changing of the guard. One-third that are going off duty, they're not really going off duty. They're a part of the plot, and they're going to be guarding crucial areas to protect this new boy king as he's enthroned. Verse 7, two contingents of you who go off duty on the Sabbath shall keep the watch of the house of the Eternal for the king. You stay on guard here at the temple complex. Don't let any of Athaliah's soldiers get in here. If they get in here, try to get in here, you kill them too. But you shall surround the king on all sides, every man with his weapons. This little 7-year-old boy king, surround him, every man with his weapons. And whoever comes within range, let him be put to death. Jehoiada is playing for keeps. You are to be with the king as he goes out and as he comes in. So the captains of the hundreds did according to all that Jehoiada, the priest, commanded. Each of them took his men. Who knew that the priest had military training capacities? He's been in the shadows. God's been preserving him for this moment, this crucial moment. And the line of David is going to be preserved. Each of them took his men who were to be on duty on the Sabbath with those who were going off duty on the Sabbath, and came to Jehoiada the priest. And the priest gave the captains of hundreds the spears and shields. Were they going to be given weapons? Well, there were weapons of David's time that were stored away in a secret place. Jehoiada had access to it. So he arms all these people. So he gave the captains of hundreds the spears and shields which had belonged to King David that were in the temple of the Eternal. He's the high priest. He knows where all this stuff is. Then the escort stood, every man with his weapons in his hand, all around the king, from the right side of the temple to the left side of the temple. Guards everywhere. Loyal guards. And he brought out the king's son. I mean, Hollywood could never come anywhere close to anything this dramatic that nobody even knew existed. Long live the king. He brought out the king's son. There's a crowd there on the Sabbath. And the rumor goes through the crowd, buzz, 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 what's about to happen? And people are getting excited. A son of David is about to be put on the throne like he belongs. He brought out the king's son, he put the crown on him, and he gave him the testimony and made him king and anointed him. And they clapped their hands and said, "Long live the king." Probably a pretty tumultuous time. Well, Athaliah is waking up to the fact that there's a commotion in the city. The queen is. Grandma is. Now, when Athaliah heard the noise of the escorts and the people, she came to the people into the temple of the Eternal. So she struts right out there. She's the queen. Nobody stops the queen, do they? Verse 14, when she looked, there was the king. She probably doesn't even recognize this boy. I mean, he was one when she tried to have him killed. Now he's 7. Who have they got this throne on, this kingly attire on, the robes and all, the crown? Who's that? Who's that little guy? Well, that's your grandson. You didn't kill him. When she looked, there was the king, standing by a pillar, according to the custom, and the leaders and the trumpeters were by the king. All the people of the land were rejoicing. Great celebration. Now, Super Bowl, last second, touchdown pass. The crowd's going nuts. There's a lot of noise. Well, Athaliah is starting to read the scene here. She tore her clothes and cried out, "Treason, treason." Boy, now isn't that, nothing's changed in 3,000 years. People who practice treason accuse other people of treason. It's happening in 2018. People that are most guilty are charging other people that are not guilty of the same thing with what they're guilty. It's called projection. It's called a smokescreen. So she's saying, "This is treason." Well, she had practiced treason. So then Jehoiada, the priest, commanded the captains of the hundreds. He's in complete control because God is behind him. The high priest, who knew? The officers of the army, and said to them, take her outside under guard. I don't want to defile the temple area with her blood. He says, don't let her be killed here. I don't want to defile the temple with her blood. Take her outside under guard and slay her with the sword, and slay with the sword whoever follows her. For the priest has said, don't let her be killed in the house of the Eternal. So they seized her. She went by way of the horse's entrance to the king's house, and there she was killed. Then Jehoiada made a covenant between the Eternal, the king, and the people. The king, this little boy, Joash. And Jehoiada is going to be his mentor. He's going to be right by his side. He's really the power behind the throne, and he's a righteous man. Verse 18, and all the people of the land went to the temple of Baal and tore it down. So we're going to start getting rid of Baal worship under Jehoiada and Joash. And we're going to rebuild the temple area. Chapter 12, in the seventh year of Jehu, Joash became king and he reigned 40 years. Now this young boy, he's enthroned at age 7. He lasts 40 years on the throne. That's quite a long time. And you could basically divide his kingship into two periods. Not exactly 20 years each, perhaps, but close. The first 20 were very good. Why? Because he was leaning on Jehoiada. He was leaning on Jehoiada. But then Jehoiada's not going to be around forever to lean on. At some point, Joash has to stand on his own two feet. We'll see that here. So he lasts 40 years. Verse 2. Here it's pronounced or spelled Jehoash. Other places, Joash. He did what was right in the sight of the Eternal all the days in which Jehoiada instructed him. Yeah, but at some point, he's going to have to stand on his own two feet. But the high place, now he didn't do it perfectly. He didn't do everything perfectly. Verse 3 says, but the high places were not taken away. There were still places where sacrifices were offered, even to the true God. But they were only supposed to be offered to the true God in one place, the temple. And there were other places in the land where people say, well, that's too far to go to Jerusalem. God's way is too hard. It's not practical. We'll offer sacrifices here to Yahweh. They weren't supposed to do that. He let that pass. He didn't tear them down. Now, it says over here in verse 19, it kind of comes to an abrupt end. Most of the rest of chapter 12 that I'm not going to read just tells how Joash wanted to renovate the temple. You know, his grandmother was the queen, there wasn't a whole lot going on at God's temple. There was a lot more going on at the temples of Baal. And the temple of God had fallen into a certain amount of disrepair. So much of that chapter 12 is him using special funding to repair the temple, which is a good thing. But there's kind of an abrupt ending to his life here. The story of it, we're still in 2 Kings 12, you come to verse 19. All it says is, the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And his servants arose and made a conspiracy and killed him. But what's the backstory to all of that? You don't get it here in Kings. You get it in 2 Chronicles. So let's go to 2 Chronicles 24. And we'll get more of the details there about the end of Joash. Maybe the last 20 years when it wasn't so good. So we go to 2 Chronicles 24. Some of this is going to sound exactly like what we just read, but some of it is going to be a lot more detail here. So we go to 2 Chronicles 24, verse 1. Joash was 7 years old when he became king. He reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba. Joash did what was right in the sight of the Eternal all the days of Jehoiada the priest. And Jehoiada took for him 2 wives, and he had sons and daughters. Now, that's not even perfect. He should have taken for him 1 wife. But here is Jehoiada trying to steer this young boy in the right way, the godly way. He even arranges marriages for him. Tries to get some moral and upstanding and God-fearing wives. Should have been 1, but you know, this was another time. They didn't get it quite right there. But he chose, Jehoiada chose the wives, two wives, for Joash. Verse 4, it happened after this that Joash set his heart on repairing the house of the Eternal. He wants to upgrade and renovate the temple, which had fallen into disrepair. So far, so good. So verse 5, 6, 7, it tells about that and other good things that he did. Go to verse 14. The plot takes a turn here. I wish it didn't take it, but it did. There's a lesson here. Verse 14, 2 Chronicles 24, verse 14. When they had finished, they finished renovating the temple. There was a special way of financing it. All those details are in there. But when they had finished, they brought the rest of the money. They had leftover money before the king and Jehoiada. And they made from it articles for the house of the Eternal. Articles for serving and offering, spoons and vessels, implements for handling the sacrifices and all that sort of thing. And they offered burnt offerings in the house of the Eternal continually all the days of Jehoiada. We keep seeing that theme, all the days of Jehoiada, all the days of Jehoiada. But Jehoiada grew old. He can't be around forever. Verse 15, our hero. He stepped out of the shadows. He's led the nation. He's led the king in the right way for quite a few years now. But now he's very old. Jehoiada grew old. He was full of days. He died. He was 130 years old when he died. I don't believe there's anybody in biblical history since clear back in the time of Moses that lived that long. So God maybe even extended his life so he could have a positive influence on Joash. But eventually, he died. God let him die. And they buried him where you don't bury high priests. You don't bury high priests with the kings. But he was, in a sense, he was the king. He was the guiding force behind the king. He was given a very special honor. He was a beloved individual. The whole nation knew what was going on. They knew Joash was doing right things because Jehoiada, his uncle, was guiding him. So it says they buried him in the city of David among the kings. Only kings are buried with kings. Except this one, this high priest, Jehoiada. A very great special honor. No other high priest that I was able to find was ever buried in the tomb of the kings of Judah in Jerusalem. But this one was, Jehoiada. And now it gets a little bit sad. We don't want it to end this way, but there's a lesson. So Jehoiada is buried. Verse 17, after the death of Jehoiada, the leaders of Judah, now the politicians show up. It's no longer Jehoiada, he's no longer around to give righteous guidance to Joash. The politicians show up, the bootlickers. Now after the death of Jehoiada, the leaders of Judah came and bowed down to the king. Oh, they kissed the ring. They buttered him up. And the king listened to them. Jehoiada wasn't around to listen to anymore. And what happened? Therefore they left the house of the Eternal God of their fathers. It was just a quick reversion to paganism. They left the house of the Eternal God of their fathers. They served wooden images. That includes Joash, the king. And idols. And wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem because of their trespass. Yet he, who's he? God. You can understand why God's wrath would be on them. After all he had done to rescue them, and all he had done to put them back on the right track. And as soon as Jehoiada is gone, the king and the whole nation go right back into paganism. You can understand why God would be very upset. But even then, he's patient. He sent prophets to them to bring them back to the Eternal. And the prophets testified against these evil practices. But they would not listen. Then the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada. And as I think we indicated last time, probably the grandson of Jehoiada, because when you compare it what Jesus said about this, about a Zechariah who was killed, as this man's about ready to be killed in the same place, very well could be the same person. We don't know it 100%, but the two accounts would be reconciled if you make this Zechariah the grandson of Jehoiada. Everything would fit into place beautifully, along with what is said in Luke 11. But anyway, this is a righteous man. either the son or the grandson of Jehoiada. He's also the high priest. The Spirit of God came upon Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, the priest. He stood above the people and he said, thus says God, why do you transgress the command? What are you people thinking about? Why are you doing this? Why are you going back to the ways of paganism? Why are you doing this? So you can't prosper. It's not going to be, blessings are not going to follow from this. You're not going to be able to prosper in God's sight. You've forsaken the eternal. He also has and will forsake you. Well, I didn't want to hear that. People are not happy when they're told that they're not pleasing God. So they conspired against him. This is Zechariah, probably the grandson of Jehoiada. And at the commandment of the king, Joash, who had been guided by Jehoiada, now he gives his permission for the grandson of Jehoiada to be killed. Joash does. Joash the king did not remember, verse 22. They stoned him. They stoned him, Zechariah, into verse 21, with stones in the court of the house of the eternal. Thus Joash, this story doesn't end very well. It started a whole lot better. Joash the king did not remember the kindness which Jehoiada his father had done to him and killed his son. And as he died, he said, the Lord look on it and repay. So, verse 23, it happened in the spring of the year. Here come the Syrians again. The Syrians and the Israelites were constantly in battle. So here comes the Syrian army, a little Syrian army. It should have been easy to defeat this little Syrian army, except for one thing. This little Syrian army was sent by God. And God is going to give this little Syrian army victory over a big army of Judah. You don't need a big army if God's behind you. Let's read it. It happened in the spring of the year that the army of Syria came up against him, Joash, the king of Judah. And they came to Judah and Jerusalem, and they destroyed all the leaders of the people from among the people and sent all their spoil to the king of Damascus. Big victory. The army of the Syrians came with a small company of men, but the Eternal delivered a very great army into their hands. The big army of Judah could not stand up against the little army of Syria because God had sent the little army of Syria because they had forsaken the eternal God of their fathers. That's one of the lessons of Israel. God will be for you unless you turn him by your rebellion against you, and then he will be for your enemies. They forgot that lesson many times. Here's one of them. So the army of the Syrians came with a small company, and God delivered a very great army into their hand because they had forsaken the eternal God of their fathers. So they executed judgment against Joash. And when they had withdrawn from him, they left him wounded. So the Syrians, with their little army, killed a bunch of the big army of Judah, took a lot of wealth, and they wounded Joash. They left him there wounded. And his servants finished him off. When they had withdrawn from him, for they left him severely wounded, his own servants conspired against him because of the blood of the sons of Jehoiada the priest. They remembered that he had given permission for righteous Zechariah to be killed. And they buried him in the city of David, but they did not bury him in the tomb of the kings. He didn't even get the burial that Jehoiada did, and he was the king, but he didn't deserve it. So, we pretty much come to the end of the story, and we see that that last one, nobody is successful in God's judgment based on somebody else's righteousness. That really is played out here with Joash. He couldn't forever lean on Jehoiada, his uncle. And when he had to stand on his own two feet, he didn't do very well. I hope this three-part series has been educational, helpful, and edifying to us, and we'll go on to the next topic next time.